Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler, January the 10th, 2014. Time sure flies when you're having fun. Just got out of the deep freeze here in the Northeast, back in the New York City. Finally, it's 34 degrees. We're well above the freezing point, well above zero. It almost feels like summertime. Not quite. I hope you've all had a terrific week. It's always good to catch up with you at the end of what is almost invariably eventful weeks. You know, there's an old Chinese curse that says, may you live in interesting times. I think most of us will agree that these times are actually more interesting than that we wish they were. As I started out saying, I am Mike Cutler. I am a retired senior special agent of what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And the purpose of this program is to provide perspectives that you're not going to likely hear on any other program. Usually my focus is national security and criminal justice, having been an agent for 30 years. But we like to branch out and do some things a little bit differently every once in a while. And, in fact, we're going to do just that. Joining me in about 15 minutes or so is a friend and former guest on my program, Horace Cooper. Interesting guy. I'll tell you a little bit more about him in a little bit. But we plan to talk about this being the 50th year of President Lyndon Baines Johnson's supposed war on terror and whether or not it achieved what he said it would. But before then, I want to just do a little bit of housekeeping, if you will, and remind you about two terrific websites. First of all, I want to tell you about two websites. My own personal website is michaelcutler.net, one word, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. And secondly, I am proud to tell you that I am a fellow, senior fellow, actually. I'm not sure if it's because of my age or what, but I'm a senior fellow with a terrific organization out in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. And boy, the climate they experience on the Pacific coast certainly seemed a heck of a lot more inviting this past week, living in a refrigerator as we've been on the East Coast. The name of that organization, Californians for Population Stabilization, is a little bit deceptive because their concerns are not limited to California, but to the whole country. And as we've seen, as goes California, so goes America. And CAPS has been around, as they know themselves by, that's their acronym, C-A-P-S. They've been around for quite some time trying to inform not just the residents of California, of course that's the focus because they're from that part of the country, from that 50th state of ours, or the 48th state of ours, 50th state, goodness. They're from the 48th state, and they focus on California in a way, but really it's about the whole country. And it's about all of the issues that we are confronting. And my area of expertise is immigration. They have other terrific writers who also write for them and contribute to their blog. And their blog can be found at the CAPS website, which is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S. Pardon me. They are a great bunch of folks, great friends out there. I hope they're listening. And I so appreciate working with them because they helped me to get this message out there. And it's a message that I keep on saying and noticing is less likely to be found anywhere else today. A lot of powerful people, a lot of moneyed people, a lot of people who I like to say are grammatically challenged. They only conjugate verbs in the first person singular who don't want the message out there. There's a lot of profit to be had by opening America's borders, tons of money. Unfortunately, it doesn't affect the average American positively, but negatively. We are destroying the middle class. We are destroying national security. We are inviting trafficking of narcotics and human beings into the United States, and it's being concealed by such nice little terms as, oh, this is about compassion and fairness and all that other good stuff, and it's not. You know, our immigration laws were enacted for two primary purposes, to protect innocent lives and the jobs of American workers. So anybody who thinks that open borders are a good idea, thinks that it makes sense to provide unknown millions of illegal aliens with official identity documents, even though we don't know why they snuck in. I mean, the fact that people came in surreptitiously, snuck in, evaded detection, evaded the inspections process should be enough cause for alarm. But of course, in the wacky world of Washington, appropriately enough, Capitol Hill built on landfill and never seemed more appropriate than today, you have politicians that are willing to forget about their oaths of office, forget about the safety, the lives, and the livelihoods of the American citizens that they were elected to represent, and are willing to sell us out for campaign contributions and the promise of votes by some special interest groups. It's madness. It's sheer madness. And that's usually what I focus on. And it does, in fact, dovetail with the issue about this war on poverty. But before Horace joins us, I want to talk about a commentary that I just wrote for CAPS, actually two commentaries. Pardon me. Forgive me for having Kermit the Frog setting up shop in my throat, it feels like. The first article that I wrote for them was Crunch Time. And my focus on crunch time is how even right now Congress continues to debate whether or not to extend unemployment benefits. And then you watch some of the talk show hosts, the talking heads on TV, who are paid very nice salaries to talk. Amazing. I wish I could get that job to just spew some random ideas that fly into my head. And they talk about the Americans that are on disability, don't want to work, unemployed, sitting home. Well, you know, it's very interesting, because since Barack Obama became the president, the number of people on disability have more than doubled. More than doubled. Now, do you really believe that people that have been working for 20 and 30 and 40 years suddenly said, oh, I'm going to look for the easy way out? These folks have a work ethic that they've demonstrated for decades. The jobs have gone away. At least for them it's gone away, but the jobs have not gone away from computer programmers from India and elsewhere. And that's what this is increasingly about, bringing in foreign workers who will work for much lower wages than their American counterparts and expect less in the way of benefits. So that's what this is about. Just as the construction workers are being replaced by day laborers, tradesmen who have skills, who went through a rigorous apprenticeship program, are being turned loose to figure out what to do about supporting themselves and their families, so that day laborers who don't have a clue can do the job, not nearly as well, there's no comparison, but to the unscrupulous contractor who just cares about maximizing profit, this is exactly what they want to do. So understand that this is not just the bottom rung jobs, it's also the upper end jobs. And in fact, earlier this week, Brett Baer talked about that very same issue, and he brought on Tom Donahue, the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce. And I wrote another commentary that I just sent over to CAPS. It's not up on their website yet. I expect it will be shortly. And I referred to it as GUI, governing under the influence, as compared, I guess, with DUI, driving under the influence. Under the influence of the people making the campaign contributions. Under the influence of, indeed, the Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahue's outfit. Under the influence of the likes of a Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and all these other characters who are focused on maximizing profit, even if it means the dismantling of the United States, even if it means the destruction of the middle class. The new war cry that you're hearing, and it's most likely from the Democrats, and I'm trying to be nonpartisan because both sides of the aisle are screwing over the American worker and the American family royally. And in fact, I'm registered as a Democrat, but I can't tell you the last time I voted for a Democrat for national office. I think that anybody who votes a party line should have their mattresses hung up on the walls of their houses so that they don't hurt their head when they bang their heads against the wall, because they need to be in a nut house, because neither party really represents the constituents that they were elected to represent. This is about the folks with big money, the big organizations, and it's hurting the average American terribly. So in any event, you have Donahue coming on with Brett Baer over at Fox News, and it was about a four-minute interview, which is about par for the course. I've done enough of those interviews, never with Brett Baer, and he seems like a likable sort of guy. But Bret Baier has this guy on, and he's talking about how there are 21 million Americans out of work or underemployed or working part-time, and they're desperate, and they can't support themselves, and they can't support their families, and we need to have more jobs because we don't have enough jobs. We have more poverty, and if we could create the jobs, then the economy would move, and profit would go up, and the sun would shine, and I guess the guys wouldn't need Viagra or something. A remarkable presentation. And then Bret Baier asked Tom Donahue, well, where does the Chamber of Commerce stand on the issue of comprehensive immigration reform? And he said, oh, this is the year we're going to get it because we have all these jobs and no workers. And what I really was stunned by was the amazing disconnect between what he said 30 seconds earlier. It's as though Tom Donahue lacks mouth-ear coordination. His ears are unable to hear what his own mouth is spewing. How in the world do you start out by saying there's an extreme shortage of jobs and we need to create the jobs because Americans are doing terribly, and then turn around and say, we have all these jobs that aren't being done? And he went on and said, it's not just the seasonal agricultural work, but even the jobs at the top end. Stop and think about that disconnect. This is the usual nonsense that gets spewed. I was very disappointed, to be very honest with you, that Bret Baier didn't call him out and say, well, wait a minute, Mr. Donahue. How, on the one hand, can you talk about a lack of jobs and then minutes, seconds later, say, well, you know what, we have so many jobs and not enough workers, so we need to bring in more workers. It's a bald-faced lie. It makes us sound stupid if we're willing to listen to this garbage. And it's got to stop. It really has to stop. If comprehensive reform was to be enacted, we would roughly triple the number of H-1B high-tech visas. And in point of fact, right now, 1 in 3 computer programmers or high-tech workers in the United States is a foreign worker. Now, that's not my statistic. This is something that was published in a report by a journalist who's actually an anchor over at CNN. So when you can listen to this kind of foolishness, Jake Tapper was the one who made the statement. On January 2nd of this year, a website known as the Global Post published his report. And let me read just the title and subtitle, because this really tells you what's going on. This is Jake Tapper, CNN anchor and reporter. Quote, the Indian tech worker H-1B visa scam, more than 1 in 3 U.S. tech jobs go to foreigners. Americans and many foreigners get cheated in the process. Obama and Zuckerberg want to let in more. Now, again, not my statement. This is the statement of Jake Tapper. This isn't about being super conservative or super liberal. CNN tends to be liberal. Jake previously worked for ABC. So this is the statement that he made. And then if you do a little bit more digging, there was an article that was, or a report that was done by the Sunlight Foundation, and CNBC reported on it. And the report of the CNBC report that was issued March 26th of 2013, about 10 months ago, said our massively one-sided immigration debate. Now, what side do you think they were talking about? Let me read to you the quote from the CNBC report that talked about the Sunlight Foundation and its report. This is from CNBC. The Sunlight Foundation, a do-gooder government transparency and accountability outfit formed in 2006 on Monday, released, this is the quote of the report, or the title of the report, Untangling the Webs of Immigration Lobbying, unquote, a report examining the organizations that have led the charge for changing the rules on immigration to the United States. Sunlight dug through 8,000 lobbying reports filed since the last big push for immigration reform in 2007. 6,712 of those involved immigration lobbying, more than $1.5 billion was spent on this immense lobbying push. Does anybody out there think this is done out of someone's generosity? This is done for the purpose of an expected payoff. And it's hurting Americans, and it's leading to more poverty. And this is the perfect segue to bring my friend Horace Cooper in to talk about the war on poverty. Horace Cooper, happy Friday. Thank you for joining me tonight.
Well, thank you for having me on the program. It's always a pleasure to come on.
Well, it's always fun. We always have a good time. We may get aggravated. Maybe we will need blood pressure pills or antacid. So why don't we share a good case of heartburn with the listeners out there today? First of all, why don't you give everybody a thumbnail sketch of your background, who you are, and why you're making all these outrageous claims?
Well, I'm the co-chairman of Project 21, an organization made up of black Americans that is affiliated with the National Center for Public Policy Research. We were formed in the wake of the Rodney King riots by a number of black Americans who looked around and heard commentary suggesting that the rioting and mayhem and other criminal behavior was somehow a justified and even predictable type of behavior that people should expect black Americans to engage in. We knew that that was false, and we figured out that Jesse Jackson and others like him wouldn't say that statement, that it was false. I have worked on Capitol Hill. In fact, I was general counsel for House Majority Leader Dick Armey. I worked in the Bush administration for a couple of stints. I was a law professor at George Mason University, and I taught constitutional law, and I frequently engage in appearances on TV and radio to talk about a lot of the kinds of public policy issues that many of your listeners are interested in, always with a focus on how do we look at the values that our founders brought to the table, what does our Constitution have to say about it, how do traditional values, limited government, and free markets help to address the issues. And so that brings us to this topic on the war on poverty, a multi-trillion dollar effort that has been all but an abysmal failure.
It's amazing. Boy, that was a quick mouthful. That was like the quickest scenic tour I've taken in quite some time. All right, so now the war, it's amazing how many wars we engage in, the war on cancer, the war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on war, I guess. What happened to the war
on terminology? The terminology seems to apply when the community or the society or the nation decides to take almost unlimited resources to tackle a challenge. Some things are more amenable to the utilization of resources than other things. You can think about the polio vaccine. You can think about the fight over tuberculosis. But other challenges tend not to be. The conflict with radical Muslim fascism may require a willingness and a wherewithal militarily to stand forward for the next 10, 20, or 30 years, but we don't know. But what we do know is that we have spent 50 years of marshaling resources to fight in this war on poverty, and what we can see is that some 16.9, or let's call it 17%, of the population was identified then as being impoverished, and that number has vacillated between 12 and 15% up all the way through this period. During boom periods, we got the number down a little lower. During waning periods, it has risen again. The truth of the matter is the amount of resources, the dollars, the labor, the effort and energy that we put in, if you translated that into cost, the nearly $20 trillion in 1960 dollars would have, if been simply given to the poor people, would have created more multimillionaires or even billionaires than we presently have on the globe. And yet, we still have systemic poverty.
Well, wait a minute. You said $20 trillion?
in $1960.
Wow. So what would they be in, that's like in dog years, what would they be in 2014?
And that dog
won't hunt, by the way, either, apparently.
Absolutely. And this is the problem, though, of
what would it be
idea.
In current money? What would it be today if we were using contemporary money?
So we spend $2.2 trillion out of our federal and our state budgets every year, and you just roll that backwards. That's this year, last year, the year before, the year before, the year before, the year before, and you start getting. Now, that number eventually gets down to $20 billion when the war on poverty starts. But you start looking at a very, very large number, well over 20 in real and nominal dollars.
And as they say, and now we're getting nowhere.
And by the way, we're talking about shooting with real bullets. I'm not telling you we spent $20 million. We haven't had a problem called we just haven't spent enough. That's simply just not true. But what is true is that too much of the whole effort in the war on poverty was premised on some things that just have turned out not to be true. 50-plus years ago, it's possible that you might not have understood how human nature operates. It's possible that you might not have been able to predict, although several people did, the consequences of the breakup of the American family. It is possible that you might not have been able to predict the creation of the entitlement mentality. A lot of the crime wave that occurred was tied, in many instances, directly to the war on poverty. We had a very, very interesting social dynamic. We had a situation where the criminal class was once a marginal group of people who simply had made as a matter of lifestyle choices that they were going to prey on the rest of us. These were people that had the opportunity to enter into the marketplace, participate, show their services, sell their goods, and chose not to.
Right.
We replaced a substantial number of those people with a new set of people, the career unemployed who actually don't have the opportunity to come forward with their goods and their services. They have been crippled. They haven't actually attained English language skills, math skills, interpersonal skills like showing up on time, being polite to customers, understanding respect, not responding to a perceived slight with over-exaggerated violence. This new class has been much more persistent. Now, we've kept the crime rate on a steady downward slope because we increased the amounts of punishment, but we could have had a period in the late 70s, early 80s, and maybe even as late as the 90s, where crime as we know it wouldn't have existed, but for the fact that we created a brand new underclass, a generation and then another generation, and then another generation. So there were these premises that may have sounded very interesting, maybe very, very dynamic in the classroom, that were suddenly implemented, and they have had dangerous and disastrous results.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Starting with this concept. Yes, sir.
Well, let me ask you a question. First of all, you know, when Roosevelt started with his idea of unemployment insurance and all this other business, I know the conservatives didn't like it, and they said, well, you know. And my argument was, well, as you just said, maybe people didn't think that someone would see an opportunity to not work but just use it as an opportunity to get back on their feet or whatever it was. So
right.
Now we have this massive – and by the way, when you say crime fell, you know, there's a couple of factors. Somebody said something to me not long ago which made me think also – we keep hearing the murder rate is down, and this friend of mine who has studied criminology said to me, well, there's two things going on. One is there might be less violence, but I don't think so, because the number of robberies remains constant. I said, then how do you account for the lower homicide rate? And guess what he told me?
good, better hospital and medical care.
Medical technology has gotten better.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
So that the guy that was shot and would have died is no longer dying, so we don't have a murder, but we have a serious assault, obviously. But the other question I have for you, what exactly did we get for the money? I mean, you're throwing numbers around that. I know the numbers are huge. So my question is, what did we get? What kind of three-legged racehorse, if you will, did they sell us?
We have gotten a permanent careerist underclass and a permanent careerist bureaucracy and a permanent careerist political class designed to perpetuate it. And that has significantly intruded upon the whole American psyche. I'm not a fan of Mr. Roosevelt, but let me say this.
Okay.
A lot of the bad ideas that he promoted actually required the individual participants to kick in.
Right.
To pay for. This
Social Security,
idea,
for example, or unemployment insurance.
Social Security, unemployment, right. Yeah, but this bad idea said, hey, why should the person getting the benefit have any responsibility or duty to kick in on creating the benefit? And that has been far worse
than
anything we could have done.
Well, I like what Roosevelt did. I'm just saying there are some folks, I try to look at things
Count me in that camp. Count me in the camp. I'm a critic. I'm saying. But at least his programs had the good sense to expect people to kick in.
You had to be a player. You had to be a player.
Idea, yes. The Johnson idea, bizarrely, came along with, no. Don't worry about needing to kick in. In fact, you don't have any duties. You don't even have to look for a job. You don't have to get new skills.
And if you have more children, we'll send you more money.
If you have more children, but, as long as you don't have a man in the picture, we'll pay you more money. Now, if we find
out... What could possibly go wrong with that?
If we find out you're saving up a little something, putting it in a savings account, we're going to audit, and if we find that out, we're going to cut you off. So let's not have any of that, saving and setting aside going on. Very, very destructive. Now, time that with the advent of the so-called sex revolution. We entered into a period during the same time when the American psyche as a whole adopted a philosophy that, or at least listened and entertained one, a philosophy that said, if it feels good, do it. People shouldn't judge other people.
Well, you did
your
say
choice
entertained.
Is my choice.
You did say entertain, didn't you? I'm sorry. I'm just taking you at your word, Horace.
Well, what this did was give exactly the wrong lesson to people who were actually sitting in quicksand. All right. So I looked up some data points between 1955 and 1960. Between that period, Black Americans were listed as 73% of them living in a home where there was a mother and a father in a marriage relationship, and those two people tended to be the people that were identified as mom and dad from the point of birth to the point of death of this child. Today, that number is almost opposite. It's 70 or 71% of Black Americans are born outside of wedlock. And in fact, the male role model is sort of like the magic eight ball. Oh, it's David. Shake it again. No, it's Billy. Shake it again. And so we don't have
what
the
an image
kind
that
of
is.
Relationship. All right, let me give you another stat.
Go ahead.
In 1957, the Department of Justice's identification of its Federal Prison Task Force identified who Fat M.M. Jail. Did you know that in 1957, the least likely person to be found sitting in our federal prisons was a black male?
Wow.
Today, they are overwhelmingly represented in our federal prisons.
Now,
okay?
why do you think
you
that is?
Fact.
Is this, again, because of the broken family and this isn't happening in the
Absolutely.
White families?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to give you one last stat on that point. When asked who was, during the so-called Eisenhower boom heading into the JFK boom from 1957 to about 1962, when asked who was the individual, described the characteristics of the most employed individual in the country. I shock you if I tell you that person was identified as a black male. When blacks were fewer than 10% of the population, they were overrepresented in the workforce.
Wow.
Today, black Americans would love if they could just be equally represented, particularly black males, in the workforce. And instead, black males are disproportionately, overwhelmingly unemployed in our system. You cannot look at those data points and not conclude, wait a second, something isn't working right. Now, here's the problem. I mentioned this using the data of black America. Gallup just announced that in 2014, 40.9% of all children born in this country will be born out of wedlock.
Wow.
We are headed in the very same path as a nation that black America ran through already. If we can't look and see the signs and the alarm and change course, we're going to head directly down that path. Now, we manipulate our employment numbers in a better, a more effective way to create today's 6.7% unemployment. By
Wasn't that a remarkable number, by the way? I have to stop you. You know, I was on a program, and I'm not just a radio talk show host. I'm a guest also. I feel like the guy that says, you know, what the hair club is.
Yeah.
But the
dessert.
Point is,
it's a shoe polish.
Exactly. But this is like the guy that comes home, the kid that's been flunking science, and says to his parents, I got an 80 on my science test. And the parents want to see the paper, and he's a little reluctant, and he finally takes it out. And they look, and he got 80% of the first question right and zeros on all the other questions. How does that work for you, Art?
He's a good starter.
Exactly, and a weak finish. But I mean,
yes.
They're not counting people that are out beyond a certain point, people that have stopped looking, people that have this, and people. So what are we really counting? Sheep? I mean, what in the world are they counting?
Well, we have created a circumstance whereby it is okay. I don't mean we approve. Of course we approve. But I mean you can survive. I won't go with thrive, but you can do better than survive by simply not working any longer in America. You're able to say, just getting up at 6 a.m. is old, tiring, distracting. I can't watch Oprah. I'd rather figure out what my alternatives are. And so, as the Representative Sheila Jackson Lee might say, we need to give some living transition assistance that occurs on a long-term basis. And therefore, people will report, I am no longer looking for a job. I have almost as many microwave ovens as the rest of American society. I have more cell phones, actually, on average, than the rest of American society. I have satellite and or cable. I
and
have
a big screen TV to go with it.
A big screen. There we're going. So, since, quote, all my basic needs are being met, and I actually don't have to get up early and scramble through and show up at interviews and all kinds of things, and I still go forward, I will, in fact, say truthfully, nope, I'm not looking. And you can increase that number and increase that number.
And here's something else that dawns on me as I listen to you. I grew up, my dad was a construction worker, and I remembered I could hear him clomping around the house in his work boots. It was a very comforting sound. You know, he'd make that cup of coffee in the morning, and he was a construction worker. He was a plumber, and I would hear him putting on his stuff and getting ready to go to the construction site. He did new work. He didn't like to do repair work. It was nice and clean, the new stuff. And he'd be out there at O'Dock 30. By 5 a.m., my father was on the road, and he'd go out there if it was, you know, 100 degrees or 0 degrees. He'd go out there if he had 103 fever. And for my dad, in fact, I carried him literally off the job his last day at work when he was 57, dying of lung cancer, in part because of exposure to asbestos on construction sites. He worked in the Navy shipyards in the Second World War, and he smoked Chesterfields. And for him, the idea of being in a hospital bed drawing any kind of money that he didn't earn was a disgrace. And so most of the people from that generation and that era and that mindset, he died in 1967, these folks were mortified to take a penny they hadn't earned. And so there was peer pressure. What peer pressure is there in a community where you're third or fourth generation recipient of these payments?
I'll tell you what the peer pressure is. Hey, fool, what are you doing getting up and studying those books? Don't you know that you can get a free check? Don't you understand that actually, at like the state of California, you can get your abortion certificates that you could go and sell on Craigslist, and you can take yourself a little weekend vacation in Las Vegas. What are you doing showing up in class every day? There's lots of peer pressure.
And
there's
that's my
lots
point.
Stigma.
And you know, families tend to travel, or humans tend to travel in families societally. Take away the family, you create a surrogate family. And I saw it in law enforcement. And what's a surrogate family called? A gang.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, when
and
I had a problem, my friends
we
had problems, you went to our parents. Someone had to have your back. When you're 12 years old, you need somebody who has your back. And if you're 12 living in a dysfunctional, chaotic environment, you know, I have to tell you a remarkable story. I used to do the marriage interviews, like you've seen on TV. You know, Sandra Bullock did a movie like that, and there have been others, to see if people are living together so that the alien gets a green card. Now, imagine interviewing a couple, and this happened to have been a Hispanic couple. I've seen it with whites and blacks. It doesn't matter. It's a dysfunctional segment of society. So you would want to see if the answers match. So you'd say to the woman, how many children do you have? Five. What are their names? And she told me. And what are their ages? And she told me. And what are their dates of birth? Half the time, you were lucky if they remembered the date of birth. So they told you as much as they could. And then I'd say, where are the kids? Where did they sleep last night? And I was expecting one slept in the living room, one slept here, you know, that kind of thing. And she starts telling me, well, my three-year-old, I think, is with my cousin. I last saw him a week and a half ago. My two-year-old is with my sister, but she might be dropping her with her neighbor because she may be making a trip down to Washington. And I said, wait a minute. You have infants and you don't know where they are? And she looked at me very perplexed and said, am I supposed to?
How
does a child grow up in an environment like that?
How long was Trayvon Martin's body being held by the Sheriff's Department before their active effort to identify who he was and find a parent hurt? I'll give you the answer. When I was a kid, if about 2 hours lapsed and I couldn't have been produced, people came looking, and I had to have answers.
Yep.
There was no 5 hours. There was no 7 hours. There was no day. There were no 2 days. 2.5 days passed, and a body is laying on a slab.
My God. My God. You know, you're making me think back to my childhood when I had started I had just gotten to the point of driving, and I was supposed to be home by 1:30, and at 2 o'clock I hadn't come home. And I walked in at 2:15, and there was hell to pay. My father said, you're out in the car. I don't know where you are. I said, but Dad, what was I supposed to do? He said, do you have pocket change? In those days, there were no cell phones. This is the 60s.
Sure, sure.
He said, I expect you to pull over and get on that phone, and not when you're due home, but a half hour before you're due home, so I can anticipate you're not going to be on time.
Absolutely.
And we all grew up that way. It was about responsibility and accountability.
That was called parenting.
And today you have parents, even when you have a mama bear and papa bear, who want to be the child's best friend. Does a 12-year-old need a best friend or a parent? If you are 45 years old and you want to be the best friend to your 14-year-old child, you better get counseling.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now our present system says to you, hey, 45-year-old, I want you to model every single bad judgment call that's possible. Hey, you want to be a recreational drug user? We've got a treatment program.
Isn't that a great name, recreational drug? You almost think that the guy is chewing on a tennis ball. What?
Well, you can show
about that
your
image.
Kid how to scam the county the county drug treatment center. Again, it's the exact opposite.
Now, what was drug use like back then? You know, drug use was so fringe back then. Bob Stutman, who was the head of DEA, made a wonderful point. I was assigned to the DEA Intelligence Division at the time, and he used to like to schlep me along with him and a few other guys when he would give speeches. Stutman was really a unique character. We really enjoyed working for Bob. And he made this speech one day, and it really struck home. He said when he started working for the DEA in the late 60s, if someone dropped a kilo of cocaine on a street corner, people would be calling up like crazy and screaming because they wanted the Department of Sanitation to sweep that garbage up and hose the street down. And this was now 1988. And he said, right, in 1988, you drop a kilo, you better call the riot cops because half the neighborhood's going to be crawling around on all fours with a straw stuck in their nose.
All right, well, as we wrap up, let me make this point.
Sure,
and
by
the
way, what's your website? Make sure you do that before you wrap up. I want to make sure everybody
gets your crayons out.
I
started with these failed premises, and I looked at the time and realized.
All right, do that and then go to your website, but I want to make sure you don't forget to do that.
The failed premise was this concept that one or two bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. could monitor and oversee 1,000 or 2,000 people who are down on their luck or having some other kind of personal difficulty. That simply was a false premise.
Right.
What mom and dad have to do is a full-time job, not something you could phone in, not something that you could have a cup of coffee and maybe make a couple phone calls, send a couple emails, and you've done your work on that particular person's interests or needs. We could not and should not have believed that simply funneling the checks to these individuals and having a few people oversee it and brag about how few bureaucrats it takes to administer this program and believe that anything other than utter failure could occur. It would turn out to be true to replace what mom and dad do without getting payment from the feds. To replace them doesn't take actually two people, doesn't take four people, but probably takes 10, 15, or 20 full-time people focused in like a laser on monitoring and overseeing and the like. Now, if you thought we've spent the $20 trillion the wasteful way, can you imagine how much it would cost if we actually decided, oh, this is a real job. This is real effort. This requires real responsibility. We can't afford to take the $70,000 and $80,000 a year people and have 10, 12, or 20 of them assigned to each and every failure. So what was going on then before we started the war on poverty? We had A, intact families. B, we had communities that were connected. C, I'm going to say it, we had the church and the synagogue. D, we allowed stigma to operate in a positive fashion. If we are going to stop the hemorrhaging, we are going to have to restore that. Instead of saying when the rabbi or the priest shows up and lectures you that that's some kind of unfair intrusion on your personal religious beliefs, we need to remember that actually those individuals, men or women, lead armies of people who care and are willing to do so out of love and compassion, what federal bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. couldn't ever achieve, even at $100,000 or $200,000 a year per person. This failed set of premises has destroyed black American families, are destroying the rest of American families, and ultimately, we could see a collapse of the whole American experiment if we don't put this back under control.
Well,
my website,
now,
www.nationalcenter.org.
Now, here's something before you go. I got to make two quick points, and I'd love your input. I know you got to be somewhere else, but real quickly. You know, you look at what they're doing, bringing in foreign workers, foreign students, people like Mitt Romney not understanding why he lost the election but said we need to start stapling green cards of foreign students on the diplomas of foreign students. Why doesn't anyone look at the kids that do want to get out of poverty, do want to break the cycle, not having the money, the wherewithal, or any resources to get out of poverty? Wouldn't it make more sense to invest money, even if it means subsidizing education for those kids showing the gumption, so they have a legitimate outlet? Do you know many people I've arrested who've been involved with narcotics trafficking and gangs and so forth who were extremely smart, who had amazing organizational and strategic thinking skills, but who had no legitimate outlet for it and so became very difficult adversaries for law enforcement?
You make my point. We took what was sort of a careerist underclass that could have been much more readily able to be managed and stopped and replaced it with a group of people who simply don't have any other choices, even with their talents, even with their smartness, even with their skills. And we absolutely need to reverse that. You're correct. Why would
we've socially engineered disasters. We have socially engineered a disaster.
And then we are in some senses, or offshoring our needs, instead of saying, whoa, you're telling me there's not one kid in the Detroit inner city that could actually handle this science or chemistry?
Here's a premise I have.
I
want to get your take on this. When Katrina struck in New Orleans and President Bush, I mean, it drove me up a wall, said we're going to suspend the I-9s, the paperwork for employers to make sure you're not hiring illegal aliens. I don't care who they hire. And droves of Mexicans came across the border and worked there, and they were thanked for working there. And I'm sure they did a nice job. But why not see in that an opportunity to make lemonade out of lemons and say, you know what, we're going to go around America. We're going to look for kids in the inner city, people who've had minor scrapes with the law, teach them construction trades. You don't have to go to college. I don't think a plumber is less valuable than an accountant.
No, sure not.
A plumber.
Right.
He was my biggest hero. When my pop showed up, it was like the cavalry. So why not say, we're going to teach you a trade, and you're going to help us rebuild the city, and we're going to help you rebuild your life? Wouldn't that have made a hell of a lot more sense?
Absolutely would make a lot more sense. In fact, it's the very kind of thing that we at Project 21 were asking the administration to do at the time. And we continue to say, as I point out, isn't there at least one kid? Why don't we just wipe the slate and go, oh, nothing to be found there in Detroit, or nothing to be found in Chicago, or any of these other inner-city hellholes? Why are we not saying, whoa, let's reverse things and at least let a few of the people who actually would like to try something different instead of generational poverty, why don't we give them a shot at some opportunity? I wouldn't mind spending some dollars on that.
Right.
But I've enjoyed coming on your show. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, and I want you to know how much I appreciate it. Belatedly, I wish you a happy, healthy, safe, successful, and peaceful New Year.
The same to you and your family. Good night.
Thank you, Horace. Speak to you soon. Well, that was the delightful Horace Cooper. He's always a delight to have on, always thought-provoking. And that's what this program is about. And by the way, I want you folks to understand something. One of the things that drives me up a wall is how many people seem to think that if someone disagrees with you, they're the enemy. And you're seeing it. We've become so polarized. People think that this is like, you know, we're supposed to have food fights. I happen to agree with Horace on just about everything he had to say this evening. It'd be hard to disagree with him. I mean, maybe there's somebody out there who disagrees. I don't know. You can certainly call me and tell me, Mike Cutler, I disagree. And the number to call, by the way, is 310-982-4145 if you want to call in. But the point that I'm making is that we need to be able to have an honest-to-God conversation. Because if you sit down and reason things through, solutions become possible. Doing the same thing the same way and expecting a different outcome is called insanity. We have had generations of Americans lose all possible hope for a decent future because our government is making lousy decisions. And Horace and his group, Project 21, are pushing back. I'm pushing back against the lunacy where immigration is concerned. My question for you out there, folks, is what are you pushing back against? I'm certainly gratified that you're listening to my program. That's why I'm here. There's no money to be made sitting here doing this. This is a labor of love because I believe in America and I believe in Americans. I don't believe in the politicians. I mean, there are some incredible exceptions. Senator Jeff Sessions sent out a wonderful press release talking about how the Republican Party is going absolutely the wrong way, that they should be looking to enforce the immigration laws to protect American jobs and the middle class and so forth. He almost sounds like a Democrat from the 1950s I won't say 60s because then we get to Lyndon Johnson. JFK, in my judgment, was the last real great president we had, and I know there's people out there that are going to disagree, and that's what America is about. But goodness gracious, we've got to understand that the government of the United States is supposed to represent the average American. That was what Abraham Lincoln spoke about in the Gettysburg Address. 300 words, barely. I think it was 200 and something words, very close to 300 words. And when you get to the bottom of the Gettysburg Address, and Abraham Lincoln spoke about a country of the people, by the people, and for the people, do we really have that today? I'm old enough that my memory goes further than I wish it did. Not my memory. I'm glad I have my memory. I don't want to lose my mind yet. I mean, maybe ignorance is bliss, but I need my mind. But if you look back, in the old days, people would say, build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. If you could be creative and you could be productive and you could be lucky, you could write the next success story. When did anyone recently hear someone talk about building the better mousetrap? And it's not because there's no more mice running around. It's because today, the new motto that replaces build the better mousetrap is you got to be in it to win it. It's about the lottery ticket. It's outrageous. In the old days, we honored the idea of the American inventor, the Thomas Edison, okay? The idea that, you know, you worked hard, you went into your garage or wherever it was you worked, and you came up with something and you made money with a great invention. And it's still happening. Don't misunderstand me. Gates is an example of that. But the point of the matter was that was seen as the American dream. It wasn't a winning lottery ticket. It wasn't a winning lawsuit. All we do these days is buy lottery tickets and sue each other, it seems like. And you know, as a relative liberal, I believe in product safety. I think that companies, when they do the wrong thing, should pay a price. I've done an article. I'm waiting for it to be published in the Social Contract. It will be coming out shortly. And it's all about how the government is destroying the middle class. And the buzzword, by the way, I want you to think about this because you're going to hear a lot of it. And when you hear it, I want you to put two and two together. Income equality. We're going to have income equality. And that's a dangerous concept, and I'll tell you why. Because what it's really saying is to remove the distinction between people with educations and advanced skills and so forth and people who basically are doing the entry-level jobs. That's dangerous. And it starts with an Alan Greenspan when he went before Chuck Schumer's House Immigration Subcommittee on April 30th, 2009, and talked about the privileged elite. And he was not talking about himself and his mansion out in the Hamptons, and he wasn't talking about Bill Gates, and he wasn't talking about Zuckerberg. He was talking about middle-class American workers, because he said that Americans with skills had become the privileged elite, what you or I would call the middle class. And he said that they were earning a wage premium. See, if he said their wages were too big, that sounds like you want to cut salaries. But wage premium, oh, that's extra money. So if we take it away, it was extra anyway, so you didn't need it. So he talked about the wage premium that needed to be trimmed, that he said we could do this by importing more foreign workers, taking down all those immigration quotas that limit all these foreign workers. And his goal, he said, was to achieve income, or at least greatly reduce income inequality. Well, if you eliminate inequality, you have equality. So now the new buzzword that we're hearing is we are fighting for income equality. So the guy with the high school education makes as much as the guy with the PhD, but we're not going to elevate the guy with the high school education beyond that. They're pushing now for a $15 minimum wage, and people are screaming this is a bad idea, except I half tongue-in-cheek have said to people, don't be so quick to criticize $15 minimum wage, because at the rate we're going, almost every American, with the exception of Gates and Greenspan and a few other knuckleheads, will be earning minimum wage. The minimum wage will become America's standard wage at the rate that they're going. That's the direction we're headed in. And if you don't believe it, look at how you drive around your communities, wherever you live. Are the neighborhoods looking better or worse? Are the fancy stores still there, or have they been replaced by dollar stores? I know where I live, a lot of the fancy restaurants and fancy shops that used to be amazing are gone, replaced by stores that have steel gates that come down, and there isn't much to steal in those stores anyway. And we're seeing this across the United States. I've been to Minnesota. I've been to North Carolina. You travel around the country. Beautiful parts of the country. I'm not criticizing the parts of the country. But crime is a problem. Poverty is becoming a bigger problem. It's there. You can see it. And people are saying, well, the recession is over because it's more than two. A recession is more than two quarters where the stock market declines or some ridiculous, you know, magical number stuff that they play. The bottom line is that when one in four American families or one in four American kids is believed to be living below the poverty line, there's something terribly wrong going on. That's not what America is supposed to be about. You don't hear about the American dream unless it's the Dreamers. This deferred action program foisted on us by a president who couldn't get the legislation passed in Congress, so foisted it on America by an executive order. And I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and maybe next time I'll ask Horace about his view, because he is, but it certainly seems that this is an end run around the Constitution. And even if you like the end run being done, let's remember something, folks, you're setting precedent. And there will be a day when someone else will want to do something else that goes contrary to the Constitution, and the precedent will have been set, and when you start screaming like a scalded cat, you'll have no one to blame but yourself and the people that got away with it this time, because what's good for one is good for the other. The Constitution has served this country so well for almost a quarter of a millennium. And now the politicians look at the Constitution as a speed bump along the way to their success. Not your success, but their success. There are very few poor people in Congress. They may have started out poor. It doesn't stay that way. And I'm not knocking all members of Congress. There are some people in Congress who give me encouragement. Jeff Sessions, Chuck Grassley, Steve King, my good friend Lou Barletta. Lou is absolutely a friend, and I'm very proud to be able to say that Lou is my friend. For those of you not familiar with Lou Barletta, he was the mayor of Hazleton. He was sued by the ACLU for enacting immigration ordinances because he had people in his community being killed by members of a Dominican drug gang. And when he went to the Justice Department, guess what? They handed him a mug and some other nonsense and said, basically, you're on your own. So he thought the only reasonable thing he could do was to try to enact ordinances to make his community less hospitable for people violating the immigration laws, and was promptly hit with a lawsuit by the ACLU. I was Lou's final witness at the trial, and now he's a member of Congress. We're friends, and I'm proud of that fact, and I'm proud of his two-fisted approach. He didn't look at a survey. He didn't look at anything. He looked at his obligation to his city. He looked at the obligation that he felt that he had, and indeed had, to the people of that town, and he acted responsibly and heroically. He's a leader. You have only a handful of leaders in the Congress. They need your support. They do need your support and your encouragement. But so many of these characters in Washington, oh, well, we're going to legalize the people because we can't. What are we going to do? We can't deport 11 million or 30 or 40 million, right? And my answer is, well, what do you do with people who sell drugs and don't get caught? What do you do with speeders who speed and don't get a summons? What do you do with people who commit all sorts of crimes and get away with it? Do we then throw out the laws and say, oh, time for anarchy? You know, there were too many damn drunk drivers on the road. People were dying left, right, and center, and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers got together, and they went out there, and they applied pressure. And the solution to the drunk driving crisis in America was to lower the acceptable blood alcohol levels in motorists, put up sobriety checkpoints, and impose harsh sanctions against anybody caught drunk driving. Seize the car, put the guy in jail, hit him with a huge fine, take away the license, criminally prosecute them. And all of a sudden, people are saying, gee, it's not worth the risk. I see I've got a caller on the line. Let's see. I think I know who this is. Who am I speaking with? This is Mike Cutler. Hello. Okay, I guess we have somebody who's just listening on the line. That's fine. So what I want you folks out there to understand is that essentially the way that the system works, let's see if we can bring this. Hello, caller. Who's calling in?
Michael, this is Steve Salvi.
I thought it was you, Steve Salvi. How are you? Happy Friday. Thank you so much for joining me.
Happy Friday to you. I've been listening. I got the back half of the show, and I can't agree with you more regarding what I would call, you know, a problem. It seems like a lot of the politicians don't want to enforce the rule of law anymore, and what was really concerning to me is, and don't let me know if you're aware of this, of the California Supreme Court that ruled that an illegal alien can practice law in California, and another illegal alien is hoping to get a similar ruling in Florida.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, I'm going to confess I have mixed emotions about it. When you look at what some of these lawyers have done where they're not principled, where they'll do anything for anybody, kind of like a prostitute, maybe the solution is to have 100,000, you know, illegal alien lawyers replace them in the legal profession, and it'll be the just reward. You know, I would almost take satisfaction. But getting away from saying things tongue-in-cheek, this is madness. In order to be a lawyer, you have to be sworn in. You have to be an officer of the court. What does that say about our own judicial system when legal status isn't even an issue? What are we going to do next? Convicted felons?
Yeah.
Becoming attorneys?
That's the problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we're going from the rule of law to rule of men, and California is a perfect example. It's become, I'm not saying it was never politicized at all, but when the judiciary becomes so politicized, you're no better than, you know, a third world dictatorship.
But that's how we're going. I mean, there's no integrity to the election system. You know, and again, I keep reminding people, I'm a liberal guy, okay? I'm a Democrat my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to know how it's unfair to say to somebody, if you want to vote, which is how we hire and fire politicians, this goes to the heart of democracy. How can you maintain a democracy when there's no integrity to the process by which we appoint our leaders? The difference between a dictatorship and a democracy is that in a dictatorship we can vote people out of power. What happens when the people in power can stuff the ballot box and they become elected, quote-unquote elected, legally, duly elected, even though the election becomes a sham. So, you know, dead man walking. You can say to people, I live in a democracy, but if the election system is rigged, abandon all hope. So you look at this and you say, well, look, you need to have ID. If I need to have ID to go on an airplane or ID to cash a check or ID to do almost anything and then say, well, it's not fair to poor people, and there are states and municipalities saying, no, we'll give you the ID for free. So now is this really about this is going to make it tough to vote? This isn't a poll tax. There's nothing like that. All we want to do, and it's not just about aliens voting, by the way, what would prevent somebody from voting for a senator or a governor, for argument's sake, by going from one district to another district to another district, casting multiple ballots from different districts for the same statewide official? And well, that could be, or the gal could be an American citizen. This is simply about making certain one vote, one person, and the person's authorized to vote. What a difficult concept to push.
Yeah, and, you know, in a representative democracy, what's really important and what has made, in the, at least in the past, the difference between the United States and other countries is that although a system may not be perfect, it still had a fair level of credibility with the population. As soon as the population believes that the elections are no longer credible, then you really, you know, anything's possible because anyone can justify anything. And if you want people to really to fall out of the system, just kill the credibility regarding our election process. And that is, unfortunately, I think that's the direction we're going. And what some politicians are doing, you know, who are fighting voter ID, I've attended hearings in which the bills in Ohio have been introduced, and the representatives answer the question, say, yes, we'll give, you know, if you believe some poor people won't be able to receive, you know, don't have the funds to obtain ID, we'll provide those free. Even when those questions are answered, they still go to the media and they say the same thing. You know, they go back to the poll tax and all these ridiculous arguments.
But you know,
here's
the problem, Steve. Here's the problem. When we wanted to build a fence on the border, what was the immediate response? Oh, Berlin, right? Germany had a fence. Now, never mind that Germany's fence was designed to keep people in, not keep people out. So you have to debate these knuckleheads. And my answer was, okay, prisons have gates, right? The White House has a gate. Does that make the occupant of the White House an inmate?
Exactly. Well, you know, and what they're doing, too, is playing games with language, you know.
But that's always what this has been about.
No. It's not paper. Show me your passport or your visa.
But you know what? You had that happen on TV with a newscaster on Fox News. The day that the Supreme Court ruled that Arizona police officers had the right, and you know, I was very much involved with that lawsuit. I provided a major declaration for the law firm. And they upheld the parts that I had hammered away at, saying, hey, wait a minute, a cop who pulls someone over, even for a motor vehicle violation, is really conducting a bail hearing. He wants to know that if he gives you a ticket, you're going to show up in court. If he doesn't believe you're going to show up in court, what's the point of giving you a summons? If he doesn't know who you are, how does he even know if that's your car? Maybe you just stole the car. Maybe you just the car's a getaway vehicle. You just killed five people, and now you're leaving the scene of a crime. So that police officer needs to know who you are. You're behind the wheel of a car. So, I mean, think of the arguments that you have to come up with. And the other side immediately said, oh, my God, and Obama comes out and says, well, that means if I go for ice cream with my daughter, the police are going to stop me and say, where are your papers? And this guy on Fox News said, was actually goose-stepping on the stage and saying, where is your papers? Now, this was the morning after when they heard about Arizona. And, you know,
and,
the way it was presented
and Mike, who are they
to the
referencing?
Public, I'm sorry?
And, who are they trying to get people to picture in their minds? Could it be Germany during,
absolutely,
you know, the Nazis?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And I have to tell you, my grandmother died in the Holocaust. My first wife's parents were inmates in the concentration camps. They were interned in the concentration camps. A lot of my family died then. A lot of my neighbors lost people and so forth. The people in my synagogue, many of them were survivors of the Holocaust. So they're going out there and comparing immigration. And I had this happen at a debate with a New Jersey mayor who accused the ICE agents of being jackbooted Nazis. Now, this is a mayor of a town. It turned out, of course, that he had a landscape business. He was hiring illegal aliens, as I later found out.
Yeah.
So you hear all these distasteful and horrific analogies. And then this guy on the TV had said, well, now these poor immigrants are encumbered by a Supreme Court decision. No, they're not. Do you know how far back, Steve, the requirement goes for aliens in the United States to carry proof of alien registration, which is what the green card is?
Yeah, well,
1940.
You know, people
think it doesn't, 1940, the Alien Registration Act, almost a century ago. 1940,
right.
What is it, 75 years ago. I mean, this is insanity.
But people
how do you make
are
that analogy?
Meant to believe this is some new thing that the government's doing, and it isn't.
Yes. And it's unfair and so forth. Go to any other country, they expect you to be in possession of your passport. We used to require, remember they used to have the public service announcements? February is Alien Report Month. And they would make the announcements in January. February 1st, aliens were supposed to go to the post office and get a form, fill it out, and send it to immigration, where they would put down their name, their date of birth, their alien registration number, and their current address. They stopped that, and I believe it was actually stopped under Ronald Reagan. I mean, these are important factors. This is about national security. What folks don't understand is that if you don't secure your borders and you don't enforce your immigration laws, you can get rid of your military. Because the mission of the military is to keep America's enemies as far from her shores as possible. How can you do that primary mission when we have unknown millions of foreign nationals, no record of their entry, no way of proving not only their name but their country of citizenship? We don't know when they got here. We know nothing about their backgrounds and nothing about their intentions. What could possibly go wrong? Think about the terror attacks. Think about the 9/11 Commission and the report they wrote. Do you know that every immigration bill should have to be compared against the findings and recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, and nobody ever brings up the Commission report? Is that not bizarre beyond belief?
Yeah, and I was just mentioned to an attorney today. I said, you know, are you aware that there was a Haitian military, high-level military leader who, I asked him, I said, guess where he was working? And this guy was found guilty of massacring quite a few people. He was working at Walt Disney World.
But we see that all the time. How many Nazi war criminals had we found in the United States?
Right.
You see, the point is when someone runs the border, and let me tell you, this nonsense that we're hearing from the politicians, oh, running the border isn't a crime, is a lie. It's a bald-faced lie that's being perpetrated because a member of Congress who had been in the Border Patrol, from what I've heard, from what I believe are reliable sources, had told members of Congress when they said, well, before you ran for Congress, you were in the patrol, is it a crime to run the border? He said, nah, it's like a traffic ticket. No, it's not, and you got to wonder if this guy's ulterior motives.
Yeah.
If you've been previously deported from the United States and you're an alien, you're looking at 2 years in jail. If you were convicted of a felony, you're looking at 20 years in jail for running the border. You mean to say a 20-year felony doesn't count as a crime?
But you know what, Mike? And, you know, I used to be a supporter of the ACLU, but I tell you what, I've heard people from the ACLU say the exact same thing. Oh, it's nothing more, it's just like a traffic ticket. And I've heard these people say this in testifying before public bodies on more than one occasion. And so maybe, you know, these are the people who are misinforming some of our public officials, too.
Some of them
they
are, but the case in point was a former Border Patrol official. I can tell you that.
No, okay. Well, then they should know. I mean, they know. They're just,
they're
lying.
This guy had an ulterior motive, and I think I know what the motive is, but rather than wind up duking it out over a lawsuit, but I know what the reason was. And it wasn't a good reason, let me tell you. It wasn't anything that would give you the warm fuzzies. The bottom line is that it's clear, if you look at the law, if you were deported and you reenter, you're committing a felony. If you enter the United States twice illegally, you're committing a felony, even if you were never deported. So, you see, running the border is a strange kind of a crime. If a Border Patrol agent sees someone running the border, he doesn't know if he's witnessing a felony. If you're a police officer and you witness some guy in a bank firing rounds and killing people, you know he's committing a felony. But a Border Patrol agent seeing somebody run the border doesn't know, because if the guy had never run the border before, then it's a misdemeanor. If the guy had been previously illegally present, it's a felony. If he'd been formally deported, the felony could carry up to 20 years in jail. This is a serious crime. So you have people spewing lies. Look, the ACLU, and I've debated them, would say illegal aliens never commit crimes. Wow. Let me tell you, as an agent, I've arrested thousands of illegal aliens. I've charged illegal aliens with firearms, which is certainly felonies. I arrested an illegal alien who had been involved with the sodomy of a little boy. I've arrested an alien who was involved in a homicide, a number of illegal aliens who were involved in murders. So you hear these lies, and I look at the guy and say, well, wait a minute, I've arrested these people. And I said 30% of the inmate population are aliens. Oh, well, that's only immigration charges. I said, no, they don't generally bring a criminal charge against an alien unless they have convictions for felonies under state or federal law. And the answer from this guy, who was a lawyer for the ACLU, was to shrug his shoulders, smile at me, and change the topic. If I couldn't get away with my lie, oh, well.
Yeah.
You're right.
And,
I used to be a huge fan of the ACLU.
Yeah.
I believe in this idea that I disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death the right to say it. And that was the point I made coming on the show this evening, about the First Amendment and its true significance. But the problem is that we're now dealing with a bunch of people, and they have a term that the folks out there need to know. It's called lawfare. I don't know if you know it. L-A-W-F-A-R-E, which sounds remarkably like warfare. If you do something that they disagree with, in comes the infantry, and who's the infantry?
Yeah.
An army of lawyers who will sue you, harass you, drive you crazy. That's what happened to Lou Barletta. He enacted the ordinance and immediately got hit with a lawsuit.
Yeah, and Mike, you know, I think that's the policy of the ACLU and cahoots with La Raza and some and Lou Lack, et cetera. What they do, and they bully community, especially small communities, who are trying to, you know, do something for the safe, you know, for public safety in their communities, and then the ACLU and the other folks come and say, if you don't do what we're going to do, we're going to bankrupt you because we're going to take you into court, and, you know, you can't afford to fight this case. And what they end up doing is then file, you know, agreeing to accept.
Well, they capitulate.
You know,
they're forced to capitulate.
But what happens is, and some of those communities become de facto sanctuary cities based on the agreement that they make with the ACLU
But here's the point. If the federal government went after sanctuary cities, and under the law they could, because aiding, abetting, harboring, inducing, shielding are all crimes under the immigration laws, and they're felonies. So if you are harboring and shielding, inducing, aiding, abetting, and encouraging, the federal government could sue. They could say, you know what, we're going to take away all of the money for law enforcement. They don't do it. They sue Lou Barletta. They'll go after Lou Barletta. They'll go after Arizona. They'll go after Alabama. The feds will.
Exactly.
Because the federal government wants the current set of circumstances to continue. And the damage, and I want to dispel a myth. This is important for the folks out there to understand. When we're told that it's anti-immigrant to enforce the immigration laws, please understand something, folks. We admit more than 1 million lawful immigrants. We give them green cards every year. An alien who has a green card is immediately on the pathway to United States citizenship. We admit tens of millions of non-immigrant aliens. Aliens who come as tourists, or they're here to study, or they're here as workers, authorized to work. We admit tens of millions. We do not have any sort of a closed-door policy. We admit more immigrants than the rest of the world combined. And the most likely victims of the violence perpetrated by the transnational gangs or the members of the immigrant community, and not just the Latino community, Russian organized crime, Asian organized crime, Caribbean drug posses. We go right down the list. How do I know? I investigated these knuckleheads. I arrested them with my colleagues. So understand, the people being hurt the most by the presence of transnational criminals in the United States are the members of the immigrant communities. The houses of prostitution are generated by the huge numbers of illegal aliens who are here without their girlfriends, wives, whatever. Some of those girls are willing participants. Many of them were tricked. Many of them were coerced. So you're looking at crime, exploitation, dehumanization. And when you stand up and say, no, those laws are designed to protect innocent lives, not just American lives, but the lives of everybody present in the United States, the other side does whatever they can to prevent that message from getting out. And increasingly, even the news media refuses to discuss the issues. Because this is about generating income. If you have a television station or a radio network and you're looking to expand into multilingual market, the more foreign nationals speaking foreign languages that come to the United States, the more that are likely to tune to your station, so the more you can charge advertisers for airtime. Everybody is getting money out of the deal except the beleaguered American workers and their families whose incomes are declining, who are losing their homes to foreclosure, who are being knifed in the back by politicians from both parties who are saying to people, oh, there's no reason not to give people lawful status even if they're here illegally.
Yeah.
Imagine dumping millions of more workers into the labor pool, fully authorized to work at a time when how many Americans are disenfranchised and can't find a job.
Yeah. And you've got the Holder's Department of Justice, or what many people might say Department of Injustice, who will come down like a hammer on people like, or cities like Hazleton, yet they let, you know, Los Angeles.
But that's what I was just saying. That they don't go
Los
after
Angeles.
Sanctuary cities that are violating federal felonies, but they go after the places like Arizona and Alabama.
And nothing's worse than
LA. How do you explain that?
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
Worst
it's obvious that there's an agenda
ever
in play, and the agenda is not what's in the best interests of America or Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Mike, I'm going to have to get off the phone, but it was nice talking with you.
Speaking with you.
Have a good weekend.
Always great to catch up with you, Steve Salvi. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Yeah. Well, we're getting close to the bottom of the hour. We've run a little bit long today, but I thought it was worthwhile. Horace did a great job. It's always good to have Steve call in. But really, folks, I want you to understand just how desperate the situation is. We're seeing all kinds of news releases coming out of politicians from both sides of the aisle in Washington that they want to enact comprehensive reform. I don't care if it's one big solid chunk or if it's piecemeal. The idea of providing illegal aliens with identity documents is dangerous. First and foremost, safety should be in everybody's mind. If you look at what the 9/11 Commission had to say, it is absolutely contradicted by the idea of giving illegal aliens an identity document. There is no way of knowing who they are. The background checks are worthless, less than worthless. I believe it was Trey Gowdy or Jason Chaffetz who had a recent hearing on the way that political asylum is being adjudicated, because the complaint was and the concern was that you have members of the Mexican drug cartels getting political asylum. There's also been terrorists getting political asylum. Look at the Tsarnaev brothers. They're terrorists. They were granted political asylum. And in order to get political asylum, you have to articulate what's known as credible fear. If you send me home because of my religion, my race, my tribal affiliation, my political perspectives, I will face persecution or worse. That's what political asylum means. And the Tsarnaev family went back to Russia after they were granted lawful status. So in any event, the Judiciary Committee held a hearing. And what was the hearing about? The hearing was about how members of the Mexican cartels are claiming political asylum, coming to the United States to either flee the violence being perpetrated upon them by their competitors of the drug trade, or coming here perhaps to kill members of the drug trade who are hiding in the United States to continue the war on this side of the border. So the people in the Judiciary Committee should be getting it. Bob Goodlatte, Trey Gowdy, they should be getting it, that there is no integrity to the process. Understand that there's no integrity to the process. There's no way that you can justify doing anything to have a system that can't deal with its workload now suddenly be inundated by, they're saying 11 million, I'm willing to bet 30 or 40 million applications. It would implode. You will wind up with criminals and terrorists getting identity documents and false names. They would not be able to do a single face-to-face interview. And it was either Trey Gowdy or Jason Chaffetz who confronted one of the administration witnesses at that hearing and said, how in the world do you do a background investigation on somebody who's never been arrested in the United States and so their fingerprints are probably not going to show up? And as I say, it was either of those two members of Congress who then said, what are you going to do, a credit check? And you could hear the anger in that congressman's voice because this is absurd. This is absurd. There have been terrorist attacks in Russia. We know that the bad guys have us in their sights. We were just attacked in April. Please, I ask you to do this. It's the beginning of the year. This should be a New Year's resolution. Reach out to your elected representatives. Cite that hearing. Cite that hearing. It was the hearing that was conducted about a week ago. It was by the House Judiciary Committee, and it was about the political asylum program. It might have been 2 weeks ago, actually, thinking about it. It was about the political asylum process and the fact that they are doing telephonic interviews. Do they even know who they're talking to? And initially, the administration witness wouldn't admit to the fact that the hearings were being done telephonically. Who in the world are they talking to? God only knows. This is a travesty, and the consequences are severe. Think 9/11. Think Boston Marathon. Think of the attacks that almost happened, but for the grace of God did not happen, because our enemy was stupid or unlucky. But, you know, I always like to say that if hope is not a strategy, then dumb luck is not a success. I mean, goodness gracious, this is common sense, folks. So anybody who says we should give an identity document and lawful status to illegal aliens is betraying their oath, is betraying the Constitution, is betraying the American people. That's how strongly I feel about it. And we the people need to have our voices heard. And that's why I'm glad to be able to join you at the end of every week to provide you with the information and the perspectives that you are not likely to hear anywhere else. I want to thank all of you for joining me today. Again, let me remind you about those great websites. My own website, michaelcutler.net. Please go to capsweb.org. I'm not the only one who writes for them. They have a bunch of great writers. Everyone has a different area of expertise. Everyone has a different perspective. But it's all about the same message, the way that things need to be conducted that are consistent with the best interests of America and Americans. Thought-provoking stuff, great website, proud to be part of that group. So to my friends out there in Santa Barbara, California, I'm hoping you're enjoying that nice warm weather that I know you generally have, and we'll soldier on in this wintry weather here in the Big Apple. I'm not certain whether or not I will be able to do the show next week. I expect to be heading to South Carolina, to Myrtle Beach, to the Tea Party Convention, but I will put out a notice and let those of you on my email list know what the story is on that. Should the program not go on next week, I will certainly be back the following week. This is the part of the week I really look forward to. Love visiting with you. I hope it's helpful to all of you. You know, I just want you to remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. This program, hopefully, will provide you with the information that you need to be a more effective citizen to hold your elected representatives accountable. Thank you so much for joining me, folks. Have a great evening. Wonderful weekend coming up. See you next time. Good night for now.